Okay, today I'm in Clevedon with professional punter Mark Holder.
Welcome.
Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us.
Thank you for coming down. Right.
Now, I've known of you for a long time, sort of the same era on the racecourse and stuff.
All good, I hope.
But I was Googling, as I tend to, and I found a quote that says, "You won't be a pro punter forever. If I did, I'd end up in a padded cell one day with somebody passing me toast under the door." Now, that was 1996, and you're still here.
So 23 years on. Well, I guess things sort of just develop as the years go by. I found it tough then to stay ahead of everybody, and it's probably tough now. But I think as you get older and more experienced, you certainly understand the way of dealing with the ups and downs that come in racing, and it makes you more able to sort of perhaps not get overly high when things go brilliant for you and not get overly down when things go against you.
Okay, now before we go into the technicalities of how you've made it pay for so long, you sort of got it in the blood, haven't you?
Yeah. I grew up on a farm, privileged in the respect that we had horses and we could ride them, but that's probably where the privilege started and stopped, because we were tenant farmers, we were fairly poor. I was the youngest of four, so I got everyone's hand-me-downs. But my father was a keen punter. He'd had a couple of horses in training as a permit. Well, he had them in training with Roddy Armitage in Lambourne or East Ilsley, and he then trained a couple under permit, which meant that he could only train for himself.
Okay, now I read somewhere that your grandfather was a bit of a gambler, lost a milk check, got better than something.
He was, yeah. We milked cows for years. I don't know, I'm sure how big the milk check was, but yeah. So it was basically, gambling was totally in my blood from a young age. And my father was more of a gambler than my grandfather, and my brother was probably as big a gambler as my father. And you know, that's all I ever saw. So I grew up with seeing people gamble. I gambled at school. Everybody says it, but I think I probably used to run a book on the Grand National at school.
And your father was a successful trainer?
Yeah, so he had a permit in 1980. So the permit meant he could only train horses for himself. But as was the case, and is probably still the case now, that people, they had a permit, the horses ran in their name, but they might have trained them for other people. So he had a bit of success with a horse called Jocks Bond and Mayotte. And indeed, Jocks Bond, who won in 1980, was, I think that was Paul Nicholls. In fact, I know it was Paul Nicholls, champion trainer, his first winner under rules, and that was at Newton Abbot. And he also won with Mayotte. She won at Uttoxeter. And the people, actually, I think Mayotte was probably part-owned or might be fully owned by somebody else, and now they wanted the horses to run in their name. So in 1981, he took out a full licence, and we started with three horses that year. Mayotte, she won five. Jocks Bond, he won three, and John's Present, he won three. So three horses, 11 winners in our first year, yeah.
And you won the Triumph Hurdle?
I didn't, the horses did.
Yes.
Yeah, 1989, yeah, Igdam. He won the Triumph Hurdle, Cheltenham Festival. I think Dad had bought him for about 25 grand at the Newmarket Autumn Sales. And he very, very slow horse, really slow. We'd run him over 2.5 miles. He just wanted a severe test of stamina. In 1989, it was the year that Desert Orchid won the Gold Cup that year. And it was nearly abandoned because of the rain that had fallen on the track. And the Triumph Hurdle, the whole course was run, you know, you can watch the video now, and they're splashing through the water on the track. And what won him that race was just pure stamina. At the top of the hill, in fact, Peter O'Sullivan, who was a commentator, he never ever mentioned the horse until approaching the last. I think at the top of the hill, he probably had, 18 horses in front of him and two behind him. And then he just made relentless progress as he won at 66-1.
Okay, at that time you were working with your father.
No.
You weren't?
No, I'd left.
So I was going to say, why did you not, obviously with that success, you'd have thought maybe you'd have a burning ambition to follow in those footsteps.
Yeah, you'd have thought so. But I wanted money. I really wanted money. And by the time we started training, 2 years in, we were training. I think the business grew from three horses in 1981 to 70 horses in 1987, probably training 50 winners a year on over flat and jumps. But I was the youngest of four. My father was brilliant at bringing in the owners, very, very sociable guy, well-liked, well-known. My eldest sister ran the yard with her husband, Pat Murphy, who she'd married, who'd been a jockey for Jim Old. And I was a long way down the pecking order. And to have any influence and to see where this might go in the long term, I worked out that probably wasn't going to make any money being there, as much fun as it was. And the days when we, as the yard grew, was we had so much fun. We used to have a bank on the other side of the farm, a 3-furlong bank where we'd work the horses. And when my father and my sister went about, we'd all get, 6 or 7 of us, we'd get at the bottom of the hill and we'd sprint up over the hill as fast as we could and we'd bet on it. And then to make it more even the next time up, if you won one of the better horses, you had to stay at the bottom and count to 1 or 2 before you were allowed to go. But great days, fun days, yeah.
So then you left and did you start working for Stephen Little?
No. In 1987, I thought I had to make my money. I thought I'd make it in business. So I saw an advertisement in the Daily Telegraph to work for Gallagher's, who made Benson Hedges cigarettes and Silkcut cigarettes. And I went and worked for them. But I was always punting throughout the 80s, very much into the form, but not, you know, I was getting paid 40 quid a week from my dad, probably making 40 or 50 quid a week from punting. Still, I've really wondered where I was going to, you know, where was I going to get to the next level in life as far as, you know, financially was concerned.
So you were making more than your wages punting. Was that back in
The 80s? No, absolutely. That's the thing. Sorry, no, it wasn't. I can remember, I think the first, I was quite unusual for a child in that when I was, say, a child, 16, 17, is that I was happier sitting at home reading form books than I was going out with my mates. So there's one defining moment, I think, came for me. There was about 1982, and it was December 1982, and I finished work for my dad. Everyone would go out. I'd sit at the kitchen table in the evening, cup of tea, my Bristol Evening Post, which had the runners for tomorrow's racing, and a form book. And I just studied the form. And I can remember that I came up to the conclusion that three horses were going to win the next day. Observe, Ekbelka, and the Grey Bomber. And they all won. I didn't have them in a treble. I bet them all singly. But that was made me believe, you know, reading form was something, a passion, an absolute passion. You just, you know, I look back and think I must have been a really weird 17-year-old to want to just sit there for a whole evening and just put my head in a form book. I wouldn't look up. I would not look out of that form book for 6 hours.
So when did you start? You worked for Stephen Little, though.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So where that was that probably when I. So when I come back into racing, probably 1989, between 1989 and ended 1991 was the time that I spent time. I was never full time for Steve, but I used to work with him, you know, on and off, sometimes for long periods of time. Great teacher. He wasn't a great fan. He wasn't a great teacher, but I learned a huge amount of Steve.
And for people that don't know, one of our previous interviewees was the probably biggest independent layer of his time.
Absolutely.
He would take massive bets.
Massive bets, yeah. People could walk up to the rails and have 100 grand on a horse with Steve. And the nice thing about Steve, and this is what I learned, I was going to talking to you about, you talking to me about inside information, and people, there's a belief that people make it pay for an inside information. Well, during the period of time from 1981 to 1987, when I was making money from betting horses, 95% of it was not from my father's horses. In fact, you could almost know too much about your horses. So I wanted to look at everything like with a blank canvas, not knowing about the horses. And Steve, who was the massive layer, hugely successful, he never had an opinion. He wouldn't tell you he wouldn't know what horses were running on a card until he put the odds up for the first race. But he wouldn't have a clue. And he would read the Sporting Life and Racing Post from cover to cover. He wouldn't read the form and he wouldn't read the race cards. Never had an opinion. And I've known Steve for 38 years. He has never, ever given me a single opinion about a racehorse. And yet, as you know, Simon, he's probably one of, if not the most successful bookmakers there's ever been in British racing on course.
Certainly. And it's interesting you say that the 1% of the value would be inside information. Well, surely if you fancy one that's not run for 4 months, it'd be good to know if that horse was fit.
Yes. Yeah, but you have to sort of choose the races that you play in. Okay, so the races I play in, I try to play in the most complicated races that I can find. The more complicated, then the more edge I'm going to have. So if I'm dealing with, say, a handicap hurdle with 18 runners and 9 haven't run, then I would be inclined to avoid that race. So I'm looking for recent form. But a couple of lessons here. First of all, my inspiration for betting was a guy called Billy Boff, who my dad had met in the late 1970s at sort of Wincanton race course. And Billy was a guy that had come out of the army and made it pay from betting for 35 years or 32 years when he met my dad. When we were having winners and runners in 1981, my dad would sit at home and wait for Billy to ring us to tell us what chance our horses had. So I'm hearing that as a 16-year-old kid. So those are the younger years are the years when you're most influenced. So I'm thinking, okay, so here there is somebody here that knows more about our horses than we do. We're riding them out every morning. So from that point onwards, inside information was nothing that I was ever going to be concerned with. And the other great story is my father had an owner, a very successful guy, trained he had a huge business in London worth in the tens of millions. He had horses with us, he had horses with trainers in Lambourne, Newmarket, and every morning he'd come on the phone, bark down the phone, "What do you think today, Richard?" Blah, blah, blah. He had the same phone calls, presumably, with every other trainer that he had horses with. And yet he was so successful at betting that the company that he bet with sent a rep to follow him around the race course to find out what bets he wanted. He was just he was a huge loser at betting, hugely successful in business. But anybody who thinks that inside information is important, I think they're completely wrong.
So was Billy Boff, was he an inspiration to you, or did he actually teach you stuff?
No, he was he didn't really teach me, because it's how can you can't really teach somebody when you're talking about a form book, but he was a real inspiration. So, because that's all he did. He just studied form. And you have to think back then, Simon, there's no videos of races, so all he's doing is looking at a form book. I actually inherited his form books that I've got here, and you sort of see how grubby they are and how, they've been thumbed through so many times. And he just knew the form. He knew the form inside out, and it's all one horse in relation to another horse, and sort of and trying to have them in a pecking order. So knowing that it could be done was an inspiration to me, and then getting on and doing it was the next step for me.
Now, it wasn't all plain sailing, was it? Because I read somewhere that you and your brother Paul, who I remember working for Stephen Little as well, lost 14 grand. Was it betting on a photograph at Sandown?
It was Stewards' Inquiry. Yeah, Paul worked for Steve Little. I guess this was probably, might have been early 90s, 89, 90. And there was a Stewards' Inquiry after the Whitbread Cup. And so Paul rang me, and I was sat in my office, asked me my opinion. I probably didn't know, I didn't have an office in those days. So I was, wherever I was sat, asked me my opinion. I said, whatever I said, there's no way they'll chuck this out. So I think Paul started backing it at like 3 on, and then it went sort of 6-4, and so more on, and then it went to evens, so he had more on it. And I think the total was about 14 grand we had on, which is probably half our total wealth combined at that stage. And they chucked the winner out who would be backing, and that was a huge loss. It's funny in those days, you just seem to get over it quite quickly though. I think sort of one or two stern phone calls between us on his way home, but I think, we just sort of shrugged our shoulders.
He didn't have to work for Stephen for free for a year or anything, and pay it
No,
all
well, he
back.
was obviously working for somebody for free because there was no money coming in. Yeah. Thankfully, I don't think he had the much of the bigger percentage of that bet than I did, thankfully.
Now, strangely, but you were one of the first ones with the 0898 numbers.
Yeah.
So in 1992, you save up, we'll ask about this in a minute, by pure chance and good fortune, you started a premium rate tipping line. So you're obviously confident enough in your prowess to sell your tips to the general public. What were the circumstances of what were these good fortune and pure chance?
Well, I think I'd gone through sort of two or three, I call them my reckless years, between probably 1989 and the end of 1991. I played poker, and I had two big disadvantages when I played poker. One is that I was awful, and the two is I didn't realize how bad I was. So whatever I was winning from betting horses, I was losing double from betting horses. Sorry, playing poker. I got married, which had lasted about as long as the marriage lasted about as long as the wedding. So end of 1991, I'm now living in a house shared by four people. I'm just studying form. I am scraping a living from just form study. I'm doing a bit of work for Steve, going racing, probably with my dad. And just, you know, just sort of think myself as a pro punter, but not making any massive money, but, you know, potentially going in the right direction. Come to 1992, my cousin, her entrepreneur, he's at a party in Bristol and he meets a guy who works for a telecommunications company. And this telecommunications company dealt with premium rate telephone lines. And they tell him there's two types of lines that make good money. One is sex lines and one is lines that give racing information. So my cousin thinks for opportunity. So he's driving home from this party. He was one of the very few people who had a mobile phone in those days. So he rings me up at 11:30 at night. He said, "Mark, come and see me in the morning." So I went and saw him in the morning. He had at the time a financial services business, worked in the centre of Bristol, prestigious offices. So I walked into the offices and he told me the story about meeting this guy. And he said, "Mark, I think that's something you could do." So I sort of said I hadn't really had any knowledge of premium rate lines, I'd never rung them. So I had a copy of the Racing Post, Sporting Life, and there was a couple advertising that day and we rang them. The first one was, I don't know, some guy in Newmarket saying, "Good morning, just come back from the Newmarket." And mind you, people were paying £1.50 a minute to listen to this. "Just come back from the Gallops, glorious morning, sun was shining, bumped into Henry Cecil, Michael Stout. I've got a lovely horse for you in a minute. I'll tell you all about that in 3 or 4 minutes. I thought, how could anyone listen to this? Another one, there was a guy talking about what he did last night and after yesterday's 4-5 winner that he'd had a bottle of champagne. They were awful. I couldn't believe that anybody, one, was thick enough to ring these, and two, if they were getting conned, because they were just dreadful. So I said, you know, whatever they're doing, yeah, I knew I could do a lot better.
So that was
1992.
Yeah. So why did you, well, that's why you did it. So you weren't making enough money punting them yourself.
Well, I was making money. But what was enough money? I was single. My exes were virtually zero and I was living quite a good life. But whether, I didn't know where that would lead to. I guess I was, 26, 27? So I had no, you know, I wanted to make money. I thought possibly I would do over the longer term, and I'd make, but you don't know how it's going to pan out. And now somebody's potentially saying to me, "Look, we can start this, and, you know, you're not going to have to use any more brains than you're using for your current job." So I thought there really wasn't anything for me to lose. And the other lines were really bad. Couldn't believe it, how atrocious they was. There was only one line at the time that I can remember who was good, and that was a guy called Patrick Veitch, who was really, knew his stuff. He's very good. So the advantage that I had working with my cousin was that I left this house where I was living with a desk in the corner of the room with a telephone and one form book. I moved into his prestigious offices in Bristol. I had my own office there. We installed SIS. I've got a secretary taking care of my every whim, making my lunch and bringing me coffee. And I was now just in a perfect scenario, a situation, just to study form all day. And I would have done it for nothing.
So your results made the line successful, otherwise people would have stopped ringing. As it's so long ago, can we talk about the sort of figures that you were copping in those days?
Yeah. For it? I can remember we started on August 22nd, 1992. I think the first day, you had no shop window, so the only way people learned about you was from advertising. So I think the first day we probably spent £150 on an advert in the Racing Post, might have generated revenue of £10. So that's a massive loss. But if you do okay, then there's a potential that people will ring back. And that's what we were relying on. So my message was completely different. I kept it really short, which cut, obviously, revenue, but made people trust you. And I think that was really important to get people trust. And also, completely different to most other people, I was telling them why we were betting this horse. So I was giving them reasons. And I wanted to give people intelligent reasons that they were not going to get elsewhere. So I, you know, explain something that I'd seen or read or understood about the form that they couldn't see anywhere else. So we basically, by about December, we were breaking level. And then 1993, beginning 1993, that's where it all turned. I think we played a big advert in a Racing Post on a Saturday afternoon, or I think probably the Sporting Life more likely. I think I advised four bets. I think three of them won, sort of 4-1, 8-1, and 12-1. And from that point onwards, we sort of created a lot more people to call, and then it just generated and generated. So to answer your question, so I ran the premium rate line for 2 years, and when we started, we were taking about £200 a month, and I think our best month in that period of time was revenue of about £35,000.
Blimey. And you had an association with Alan Potts at the time?
No. Alan came later. So Alan wasn't with me when I had a premium rate line. I changed it. Do you want me to talk about changing it, or do you want me to talk about Alan Potts?
No, you can talk about whatever you want.
So after 2 years of doing this premium rate line, and of course you're only getting paid for talking, so that's not necessarily a problem, but what it leads you to do, you're under pressure to find stuff every single day, even though on days there may not be stuff to find. So, and you're doing two messages, one at 7 p.m. in the evening, another at 11 o'clock in the day. And I just found it all too stressful. And that sounds really weird because there's lots of people who've got stressful jobs, but it was a lot of pressure.
£35,000 a month.
No, well, not everyone. And I wasn't keeping all of the money either. There's a story about that as well. When I started with my cousin, I said, how are we going to split it? And he said, well, we'll go 60-40. And it wasn't until we got the first paycheck that I realised that he was getting 60 and I was getting 40. So after 2 years, I changed it. So then, this was a big day. So I said to my cousin, I said, right, I'm not doing the premium rate lines anymore. We'll put it on a standard rate telephone line and people can pay us a fee. So overnight, I just stopped it and went on my premium rate line. I said, right, I'm not doing this any longer, but you want to pay us a fee, you can pay us a fee and you can get the information on a standard rate telephone line. Which I think was in everyone's advantage, apart from the people who were ringing from work, who were obviously very disappointed. So we changed that, and then the next day, I can't remember how many people subscribed, but we took £107,000.
Were you still backing them?
I was still betting horses, but I was still betting. But my priority was absolutely doing a good job for my clients. So if you think about the business to that stage, I had my cousin ran it. He was sort of like taking care of the business. My job was to get up in my office at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd stay there till 8 o'clock at night doing something that I had done for free. And all I had to do is study horses. And I could think about ideas. It was absolute dream job.
Okay, now, so before we go on to Alan Potts.
Sorry, Alan, yeah.
Steve Goff.
Yeah, well, let's
talk about... You want to talk about Alan first?
Yeah, I'll talk about Alan, because Alan... Right, okay. So Alan I met at Cheltenham. I liked Alan a great deal. A huge integrity, which was most important to me. Very honest, straightforward, straight-talking guy. Knew his stuff. I was predominantly National Hunt. He was probably more on the flat. He joined me, I think, the week of Goodwood. He did very, very well. He understood about draw biases. Not before everyone, but before a lot of people. Very value orientated. Again, it was really important to me that he sort of bought into what I was trying to do. My clients, customers were really important to me, and he bought into that. And he used to come in, sit in my office, and talk to my clients once a month by phone. So Alan worked with me for 2 or 3 years, and I learned stuff of Alan for sure.
Now, Steve Goff is somebody. It's the reason we got in contact with each other, because you've seen it in a previous interview. So he seems to have been a big influence on a lot of people.
Steve, a massive influence, yeah. So Steve Goff, yeah, very, very clever guy. My brother was, by this stage, this is probably late 90s, I guess. My brother was an on-course bookmaker, and he used to go to Wolverhampton on a Saturday night, and he met this guy. And he come back and he said, Mark, there's this guy you should meet. I said, yeah, why? And he said, he's really clever. And I said, okay. So I said, well, tell him to ring me. I can't believe I said that. Tell him to ring me. So my brother's gone off to the races and says, Steve, ring Mark. Steve's not too busy. So I went to Wolverhampton and rang and met Steve. And when you meet Steve, I don't know if you've ever met him.
No,
he's you wouldn't meet him and think you're in the, you know, this is a genius, you know. I can remember meeting him at Wolverhampton in the in the betting shop at Wolverhampton Races. And he's got a scrumpled up racing post, so like a little pen behind his ear, 12 betting slips. And I sort of started chatting to him, wasn't really getting a lot out of him. And I said, I was getting cut to the chase. I said, why'd you win then, Steve? And he sort of, in his sort of Birmingham accent, he said, I don't know why, I win, I just do. And, you know, and I just thought, oh, Christ, this is going to be hard work. But I got to, I sort of took his phone number, started ringing him, and realised that he was doing stuff that I wasn't even thinking about with sectional times. He was sort of timing horses from different points on the track. He was timing horses from hurdle to hurdle. I then went to his office and home in Shrewsbury. His office had TVs all over it, all sort of linked up to video cassette recorders, recording everything, looking at horses from different furlongs, parts of the track. Absolute genius, total genius. And much of what I do today, well, everything I do today stems from my meeting with Steve.
Okay, now back in the sort of mid-90s, if you really wanted to, if professional punters went racing, didn't they?
They did, because it was no betting course, no betting tax on course then. It had been abolished in 1997, I think.
Yeah, so I remember Eddie the Shoe, Alan Potts, a few others.
Yeah.
There was a little nucleus of pro Alan the beard with the big glasses.
Always had a can of Coke in his hand.
So tell us a bit about the what sort of characters and punters on course. Were any of them an influence on you as to what you did, or any that were big characters just because they were that you want to talk about?
I can't say they were massive. I think the influences were people like Steve Goff, Steve Little, Billy Boff, and certain other people. I can't name them as one massive influence, but what I did when I was going racing, I would sort of sidle up to people who I thought I could learn from and ask questions. And I think that was a big part of helping me sort of progress, was the fact that I wasn't afraid to ask stupid questions and to find out from people. So you like people like Eddie Fremantle, who I've known Eddie for 25, 26 years. One day you could turn up to the races and he would be forthcoming and welcoming. And the next day you could turn up to the race course and get him on a bad day. And he would and you'd sort of think, have I upset him? But there was, so lots of people. And the race course at the time was sort of full of faces. I wouldn't have regarded myself as a face at the race course, because I was probably more based in the office. So my 100% of my living was not coming from betting horses. It was coming from advising other people. There was a certain snobbery about at that stage. I'm not sure there still is, but that if you bet purely a bet, then you were up here. And if you bet and you advised, then you were down here. And I sort of couldn't quite work that out, because I thought, I'm not a charity. People aren't paying me money because they feel sorry for me. They're paying me money not to tip a horse, but to make the money. And that's really what it came down to. I always said, you don't need any expertise to fill out a betting slip, but you need a tiny bit of expertise to make it pay.
Okay, we talked about the sectional times, which gave you a massive edge.
Yeah.
You mentioned to me before we started doing the interview that sort of edge eroded slightly over the years.
Yeah.
As more people have started to understand the value. So when one edge erodes, you have to find new ones. How do you go about that?
Every day I get up and think about, where am I going to find an edge? So I guess every day that I've done this professionally for 27, 28 years, I've always wanted to look for something that I can see that other people can't see. So I don't think you ever get up and think, I tell you what, I need a new edge. I've got to find something. You're always looking for something. So I'll give you an example recently that I've started to do, probably the last 3 or 4 years, is look at the way horses gallop. Nobody looks at the way horses gallop. Well, some people do, but not many. And if you watch me run down a road and you didn't know me, and then 10 minutes later you watch Mo Farah run down the road and you didn't know him, and then somebody said to you and 100 other people, who's likely to be the better athlete? 100 people would say Mo Farah as opposed to me. He flows, I run like a giraffe. And it's the same with horses. Good horses gallop fluently. So I can see horses that will never be any good. Will never be any good because it's just the way they move. The legs don't work properly. So I started to analyse the way horses move, and also look at them what then creates a ground preference for them. So it's not a hard and fast rule, but generally, if horses have got low flowing actions, i.e., when you watch them gallop, the hooves don't particularly leave the floor.
Daisy cutters.
Daisy cutters, is that right? They're going to want decent ground. But you get horses that have got big knee actions, then they're going to, the softer the ground, the better. It's not a hard and fast rule, and so I wouldn't say to everybody, always judge it by that. But what that tells you then, so Simon, so probably at the moment 70% of horses I have a figure for that rates them between how they gallop. So you get a horse that runs on a good surface that's got, you know, I'm talking about a sounder surface, who's got a knee action and perhaps wins, then people who read the form book would say, right, oh, good action, and that's how, sorry, he's won on good ground, so that's the ground he wants. And so, but I'm thinking he's going to be even better on softer ground. So it just, that gives you another little edge. And also, you know, you talk about sectional timings, that lots of people do it now. When I started, I only knew two people who did it. But it's also how you interpret it. You know, it's, everything is down to interpretation as well. So a lot of the edge is gone, because before you could see, there would be horses who would, I say before, I'm talking about early 2000s, would be racing at 3-1 that you wouldn't back if they were 16-1. And those edges are gone. You know, the horses that won by 20 lengths but were winning dreadful contests, you know, that were always over bet next time. But if you interpret it correctly, and you can still find edges with the sectional time. So I certainly wouldn't put anybody off investing their time in doing them.
So how do you know when an edge has come and gone?
I guess when it stops working. The big edge, when I started doing sectional times initially, what I noticed was that horses, this was coming back on the back of Martin Pipe's success in the 80s and 90s, where most of his horses front ran, most races were being run too fast. So there was just a massive edge in the early 2000s, probably to about 2010 or 11, where if you just bet held up horses that could be held up in 16, 17 runner handicaps, you had a massive edge, because the fact they were going to be held up, the leaders were going to go too fast, you could back them each way, invariably, not always, but the leaders were going to stop, and you might back the horse that's the 10th best horse in the race on form, but he was going to run beyond that because the race was going to be run to suit him. And then Ruby Walsh came to this country, and if you have a look at when Ruby Walsh started coming over here, he's probably here, what, 2007? Probably a bit before that. But I remember being at Taunton one day, stood in the middle of the track, and probably a handicap hurdle, Ruby Walsh is riding a 10-1 shot. And they're halfway down the back, and all the other jockeys are in front of riding away, and Ruby Walsh is just sat at the back, probably 12 or 14 lengths off the leader, not moving, absolutely knowing that the horses in front are going to stop. And he was a massive influence, and I think he did not on me, but on other jockeys. I think he did an interview in 2012, when he said, why was he so successful? I don't think that was a question, but he said he just comes over to the UK and all he had to do was sit at the back and wait for the races to fall apart, which is they did. And now that has turned full circle. So the question was, well, how do you know an edge is eroded? Well, that, I probably followed that over a cliff, and it probably cost me money about 2013, 2014. I probably lost money in those races, still believing these races are going to be run fast. Okay, we've had some that are run slow, but I know they're always run fast, but they weren't. And now they generally run too slow or at the right pace.
So do you think the lifespan of these edges has decreased since the internet's given everybody a lot more information?
Well, it all depends. If you're on Twitter and you sit there and you tell everybody how clever you are and the edge you found, yeah, I think it does. But I think if you're like me, who doesn't try to talk to anybody if I can help it, and you know, I tell my clients the edges that I believe, but they're not going to try and find them themselves. I'm telling them because I want to explain where our edge is. Then I don't think they'll erode, and if they do erode, there'll be new ones. So what you ideally want is about five edges to come along and to see them all at the same time. But as one goes, there'll always be ones. I mean, you could come back here in 10 years' time and I'll be talking about, hopefully, different ways that I approach this sport that I would not have even considered today.
Okay, now how do you approach? So you get up in the morning.
I don't. You're middle of the afternoon.
You're itching to study the form. How do you start tackling today's races?
Right. Okay. So I choose. So I specialise in hurdle races. I pick the hardest races of the day. So I want to be backing. I want to be backing handicap hurdles where there's recent form. So if more than 30% of the runners haven't run this season, I'd avoid them. So ideal scenario: 18-runner handicap, where I can. So 18 runner handicap, and I will then look at every single runner in that race as if I've never heard of the horse. So I start absolutely afresh. Obviously, I've rated all the horses from times. I don't rely on anybody else's ratings. I compile all my own, which are all time based on sectional times. So doesn't mean to say the end figure is not the figure, i.e., the final figure of that race, i.e. 3 minutes 53 isn't the important bit, it's how the race was run. So I look at every horse in a race via form. I'll then look at a video, the last runner, probably 75% of those runners, and then having all that information, I'll then try and assess a tissue of what I believe is the right price. So I'll try and come up with a price for every horse, well I will come up with a price for every horse in that race that represents absolutely the midpoint between what I'd want to back it at and what I'd want to lay it at. And that process probably takes as long as, well, not quite as long, probably about half an hour, 45 minutes, just to look at those prices. And when I'm doing that, I will not have seen a price. I won't have seen a betting forecast. I won't have spoken to anybody about the race. I certainly wouldn't have looked at Ozchecker. I'll have had no idea. So when I put those odds, when I've finished with my odds, they are how I see the race, not how, that's totally an influence. My mind is not polluted at all by anybody else's opinion. And then that then gives me what I think the prices should be, and then I forget about it until 12 o'clock. I don't get involved in, I never look at the markets until at least 12 o'clock, probably later in the summer. So I'm not influenced, I don't care if a horse was 20, if I think a horse should be 8-1 and it was 20-1 and is now 12-1, I'm not annoyed that I've missed the 20-1 and now I'm going to back it at 12-1 because I'm still getting value. Equally, if I want to back, I think a horse should be 6-1 and it was 9-1 and now it's 9-2, I'm not going to back it, but I'm not going to lose any sleep about it. I'm purely betting horses on having the value with me.
Right, so you would you not be influenced by the exchanges if something was on a massive drift, or would you be having more on that you fancied? If you thought something was a 10-1 shot, it's now 25, it's been 10 in the morning, would that not put you off?
No, because if there's, let's say it was a 16-runner race, a 18-runner race, or a 10-runner race, and I'd put it in at 10-1 or 12-1, I'd have a belief in that price. Let's just say I hadn't run for 500 days. Now, I don't know what price that horse should be, so I can only guess at that price. So I'm not going to bet that horse and I'm not going to lay that horse, whatever price it's put in. So let's just say I put in at 16 and it's, when I look, and it's now 5-1. So what I'll do, I'll adjust that to allow for the percentage the bookmaker's got in his favour. So I'll probably adjust it to 6-1 or 13-2. And then I will alter automatically everything else around it. So let's say that horse's true odds are 13-2. Give it what? About 13% chance of winning. So I then alter everything. I'm not going to bet that horse, but I would be happily oppose it because I'm assuming that's about the right price. It's at the right price at that point. So if there was something that ran 2 weeks ago that I think is a 2-1 shot and it's 10, I would have more on. That's absolutely what I would do. And those are the situations where you make money.
Okay, Mark, in this final part, we started off with your quote from 1996. Yep. You're going to be in a padded cell with your toast being put through the door if you carried on professional punting.
Under the door.
So here we are in a very, very nice house just outside of Bristol. And I haven't seen a padded cell anywhere.
Right.
So how have you kept sane doing this?
I guess that I've focused my whole life on it. So it's always been the most important thing. I mean, I know that sounds pretty sad because, you know, obviously got married and have kids, but it was always always been the focus. And that's, you know, I think if you're going to be successful, really successful at anything, it has to be the focus. You can't do it part-time. So I've made sacrifices in other parts of my life. But by keeping ahead, then I didn't have to have the mental stress of having dreadful times and trying to balance personal life against professional life. I think my family knew that my professional life was really important to me, and they would obviously have the benefits of me being successful with my professional life.
Now, would that, a wife and kids, not have put added pressure on you? And it's gambling, let's not forget, you are, well, maybe it's not gambling for you, you're confident enough in your ability that it's not gambling, but it's still gambling. You still get the bad luck, you get the beating the nose a couple of times, you get one fall at the last. How do you handle the losing runs and do not get them?
Oh, yeah, definitely get losing runs. Had hideous losing runs over the time. I think as I said at the beginning, as the longer you do something, then the more confident you become. So when I was starting out and going properly in 92-93, I would have been probably 70 or 80% certain that I was going to make it pay. Now I'd be as close to certain as I possibly could be. I think unless I get dementia and then you have to keep me away from the computers and mobile phone, or some hideous accident occurs to me, I'm going to struggle to lose if I can look at it with a sane mind every day. I think the only time, this is just a very brief story, the only time I got really affected was, there was a horse called Special Envoy. He ran at Aintree 2007. He was running the handicap hurdle. I think it was the last day of the Thursday. And he had put up a magnificent performance 2 or 3 weeks earlier at Newbury, and he'd won, like a novice hurdle. People had totally underestimated the value of that form. I think I backed him, I backed him to win five figures. I gave as a confident bet to my clients as I had on a horse at that price. He was seven lengths clear at the last, and people need to look at the close-up. I think the close-up was something like seven lengths clear and going further ahead comfortably when he fell at the last. I think that was the lowest point that I have had in all the years that I've done this job. And then on the Friday of that meeting, I couldn't even look at a horse race. And then on the Saturday, first race on the Saturday was a competitive handicap. I bet two horses, I advised two horses as well. And the winner was King's Key at 1 at 16 to 1. So that just shows you can go from the really, really low point to a good point quite quickly in this game. And I think that's, you know, you have to remember. But only happens, Simon, if you work hard. You know, you've got to be resilient.
Okay, right. To quote the great Barney Curley, if you're somebody like you, bookmakers won't lay you two bananas to one banana.
Yeah.
So how do you get on?
Well, so that's, well, it all changed in the beginning of 2001, when there was betting tax. You could ring up Stan James on a Wednesday afternoon and have 500 each way on a 6-to-1 shot and a 9-run handicap hurdle, nine-run and novice hurdle at market raising with an odds on shot. You could comfortably do that. It then got progressively worse and progressively worse. So betting took a sort of, my focus was primarily my clients. Betting took a slight step back up until about 2008. At 2008, I decided I'm not going to take any more clients for differing reasons. So that's time I just started looking at from a betting as a, so the betting was the foremost thing in my mind. I employed a guy, ultra clever guy. He sat in an office. He was, attention to detail was fantastic. As many friends, family, people I met, I asked them to open bank accounts. I put money in their bank accounts. I got them to open up accounts with a list of bookmakers that I'd give them, and I'd give all the information to him. And then I would text him through, and he probably had 14 Corals accounts, 14 Victor Chardler accounts, all sorts. So we did that from probably 2008 to 2014, quite successfully. He then went off and got himself a really good job. And then for the last 4 years, my turnover is probably in horse racing has dropped by 75%. Turnover, I'm talking about in straight bets, when it was like 95%, and to now 50% is Betfair and 50% is straight bets. And I now probably have three or four people who I ring and put my bets on, but I don't bet anywhere near as many horses as I did, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Now, you mentioned that you stopped taking new clients, but you still got tipping service.
It's an advisory service.
It's an advisory service. Yeah, so, How do they get on? Because they're obviously winning. They wouldn't have stuck with you.
They get on. They're very shrewd. They are my clients are the shrewdest people. I tell you, Simon. They have cousins, aunties, uncles, friends. Yeah, the stories I hear from them. But the nice thing is for them, well, they're very good judges. One is they put total trust in me. I don't get any hassle or aggravation for them. But their one objective is to get on. And so they get on. They don't have to think about trying to find the bets. They have trust in me that the bets I give them will make them a profit. So some of them bet them in betting shops. Some of them would have loads of accounts. They'll always have their sort of different accounts. I won't mention independent some firms. But some of them open accounts with like Bet365, bet £2 on the top scorer, on a Saturday afternoon for the first 3 months, 3 or 4 months, and then start betting in smaller sizes. So they all, you can always get on, but it's just the amount of effort you want to have to put into getting on.
And do you move the market? Do you notice when you put one up?
Not really, not anymore. Used to move it quite considerably, but then I had probably 4 or 5 times as many clients then when I was promoting the service as I do now. So it moves a little bit, but not a great deal.
So have you ever come precariously close to the edge that this all gone? You've gone so badly that it's nearly gone tits up.
I've never come close. I don't think financially I've never come close. Mentally, yeah, I think you often sort of, in the early days, because it is up and down and you don't know what's going to happen. So again, I think if you can push yourself through and show resilience through the tougher times, then you come out a better time ahead. And then when you go through another tough time, well, you recognise that you've been through this before and you come back, you'll come out of it the other side. And I tell you, Alan Potts, one of the best things he ever told me, when he was going through a bad run, what he did was he would look back at all his successful results. And I think what people tend to do is they tend to look at what's ever happening today and then stretch it out into the future. So whether they're winning, and they stretch out, I'm never going to lose, or they're losing and they stretch out, I'm never going to win. And neither is true. I always sort of said to my clients in the past that when I'm winning, I'm not twice as good. I'm not half as good as you think I am. And when I'm losing, I'm not as bad as you think I am. So it's things that tend to average themselves out over a period of time, I think.
Okay, now just changing the subject slightly, I'm very pleased to hear that you've been watching a few of these interviews. Now, you want to take issue with something one of our previous interviewees said.
Taking issue is probably a stronger term than I would give it. No, but I just thought one of your, what was his name?
Mike Spence,
yeah. I think he said about, talk about value, and value's really important to me because it is the most important thing in horse racing. Whatever anybody else tells you, they're wrong, because it is the most important. So you have to bet horses at the right price. If you bet horses at the right price, you will win. If you bet them at the wrong price, you will lose. And I think he made a point in the video that, well, how do you know the right price? Because the price is forever changing. And then if your horse is up against Frankel, well, whatever price you back any of those horses against Frankel on that day when Frankel hadn't run, you're betting at the wrong price. And my view is that we've only got the information that we've got at the time that you place the bet, at the start of the race. So you can only go on the information that you have at that stage. And if you put all the information together at that stage, you can, and you're correct, then you'll come up with the right odds. Now, if you back a horse at 5-2 that you think should be 6-4 and he falls at the first, well, he's gone from, you thought should be 6-4, but he's now 1,000-1. But you've backed him at 5-2. So the price is forever changed. But when you place the bet, you can't say, well, this could be a good or bad price, because under those circumstances, every horse that wins should be 101, and every horse that loses should be 999. Because I'm talking about the exchange prices. You can only take the information that you have at the time you place the bet.
Okay. Now, obviously, this is true because it's worked for you for 30 years nearly. Is it harder or easier now to make a living as a professional punter?
I would say it all depends what you just would say was a living. If you want, I think it's easier than it's ever been now to make it pay, for sure, because when I started, there was no Betfair. So, and you were playing, the bookmakers had bigger over rounds, as you'll remember, in sort of the mid-90s. So I think it was harder to make money then, but I think it's harder to get amounts on nowadays. So I think if you, so I think you could make more money in the past few, in years gone by, but now it's, there's no excuse really if you show a little bit of intelligence not to make some sort of profit.
Okay, now these interviews, especially ones with people like, say, professional punters, very popular, people like to learn from them. Now, they obviously can't join you as a client, which is probably annoying a lot of people, but
I don't know what,
what would your advice be? What are the golden rules of professional punting? What is the do, what are the do's and don'ts?
Well, I think the first golden rule is don't have any golden rules. Really, don't fix yourself down to think what you should do. If you're starting out from scratch, I would say study form, don't watch videos. And people will be up in arms about don't watch videos, okay? If you think about it, if you watch football, right, so they're clever, aren't they? They're clever syndicates who make lots and lots of money out of watching football and betting on football. If you sat me down and asked me to watch a game of football, I wouldn't have a clue what I was looking for, which were the relevant points that were going to make me money. So I'd say study form. Like if I study stats on soccer, then I might have more of an edge. It might make me understand it more. So I'd say study form, look at form, and then perhaps look at, spend 5% of your time or 10% of your time studying videos. But 90% should be looking at form. I'd say expect to lose initially. You know, you are going to lose. And have resilience and keep coming back, because the difference between, not just in this business, but in every business, is the people who get the setbacks and just keep coming back, try again. Everybody, Simon, that you have interviewed who's been successful, me included, and probably more so me, has failed loads and loads of times. We have all failed, but we failed and we learn, and then we try to understand why we failed, and then try to sort of learn from that experience and then move on again. And going on to what people should look at, I would say look at the lowest grade of races. Study the lowest grade. People say they're inconsistent horses. They're not. They're no more inconsistent. They're talked about as being inconsistent because people don't look at those horses, and it's easy to say, well, they're all inconsistent, and the better horses are more consistent. I think there's more edge in the lower grade of races because I think they're less studied than the bigger races.
And do you think you can trust the horses be running on their merits in those lower races?
I think you have to. I think you have to. You will get horses that perhaps might improve for run. But I think generally, I mean, most of my best touches have been in low grade races, at horses on big prices. There, where there are people have got fewer opinions, people aren't looking at them so strongly, and I can form a judgment about a horse that I know is correct or not correct, but likely to be more in tune with actually what the horse is capable of doing than other people perceive it. And that's where you'll make your money. You'll make your money by having a different opinion to everybody else. If your opinion is the same, we go back to spending time looking at races, pricing up 18 handicap hurdles. I'm happy to spend 2 hours on a race and not have a bet and not really have an opinion after 2 hours. And that's what you've got to be prepared to do, because you will then find your wait for the opportunities, the right opportunities, when you know that, or you believe strongly that you have found something that other people perhaps haven't seen, however small it is.
Great advice. Well, Mark Elder, thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.